In 1991, Reverend Eric Williams was a young pastor who'd just begun his ministry at a church in Kansas City, and he got a call about a 25-year-old man who died of AIDS. The pastor at the church the kid had belonged to refused to do the funeral. The question was, would Eric do the funeral instead? He remembered his initial response to that request years later for StoryCorps.
Didn't want to do it. It's not appropriate for one pastor to go against what another pastor has said, this is what I'm going to do in my congregation. And I was perfectly all right with that until I went home and started thinking about this family.
Eric's entire approach changed as a result of that phone call. It wasn't just that one funeral he did. He actually ended up dedicating his ministry to providing pastoral care for people with HIV and AIDS and their families.
You know, everything good that I've been able to accomplish has started with some kind of a burden, and AIDS burdened me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're going to hear the rest of the story that changed Eric Williams' life. Reverend Eric Williams, good morning.
Hey, Gina, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Tell me about the decision that you ultimately made to meet with the family of that young man who died of AIDS. It must have been a hard one since it went against established church norms at the time. You went home, you thought about that young man and his family. What was going through your head?
That they were alone, but it really didn't have much to do with me. And this was one I could have stayed out of and would have been kind of okay. But I couldn't. You know, after speaking with my wife about it, she convinced me that that's not how I usually react to things.
Can you explain what it was, the sort of, what it was she said to you that changed your mind?
It's probably something like, who are you? you know how sometimes when you do things that are out of the norm, people expect something more from you. Maybe it's a black mother's guilt or whatever. Whatever she said, whatever she did, convinced me to take a second look at it. And I'm eternally grateful that I did.
What did you see on a second look that was different from a first look?
The pain of the family, and you know that's what we do. We respond to what I like to call the pain in the valley. It gets pretty easy sometimes if you're the pastor and people sometimes have an ivory tower kind of look at who you are. So it gets easy for some to stay in the ivory tower high above the filth and the muck and the mire of real life. And you can ignore it if you stay there. But when you peek down into the pain of the valley, It grips you and burdens me, and forces me to react. And
in that StoryCorps conversation, you talked about how you were seeing a lot at that time of fathers disowning gay sons.
Yeah, that was the norm. It was kind of the norm. It was it's a wrong norm, but it was the norm. Everything you saw was. Black and white dads saying, I didn't raise a son to be this way, and taking offense to the fact that there's a difference now in my family. And how does that make me feel, or how does it make me look?
Wanting to create distance.
Right, right.
You were touched by the fact that this young man's family was standing by him and standing by him after his death.
Yeah, they were so warm and wonderful, embraced his legacy and memory as well as his gay friends at the funeral. And as uncomfortable as it was for me, they made it comfortable for everyone because it was sheer love. On display.
It sounds like their comfort was more important to you than your own.
Yeah. Sometimes those things are scary. I think at at risk for me was, you know, how my congregation felt about it. And it could have easily been a short story. It could have been black minister with Jerry Curl announces that we're going to support gay and lesbian people and love them. And the Calvary Temple Baptist Church fires him on the spot. That it could have went something like that. But, you know, without my congregation on my side, none of this stuff would be possible. And so they helped. They helped. And they
helped
it.
How? Can you remember the just that process of looking around you at your community, at your congregation, and kind of awaiting a spoken or unspoken verdict?
One of the first things that we did as an activity to try to prevent the spread of HIV was training. I felt that African American churches could be ground zero for support and education. All the good things that have come out of the hallowed walls of the church, the civil rights movement. You know, it's the place for information. It's a place for guidance. It's a place for love. My silly self, I felt like congregations could be effective in doing that. So we started establishing trainings. And in the training programs, there's the condom demonstration. So in my office and my small church, one of my deacons acted as the maintenance man, and he was cleaning up my office before we really got into it much, and he found this big box of condoms, and he came secretly and whispered in my ear, "Reverend, is there something that we really need to talk about?" And I said, "It's for training. I'm not cheating on my wife. This is not not anything like that." But the transition and the discussions that went on. Because you got to talk about sex in church, and not the most comfortable place sometimes to talk about it. Yeah.
What had your own feelings been about this disease, AIDS, and its social significance, its connection in many people's minds, especially at that time with being gay?
Yeah, it was very, very new. I was clueless. And so,
and arguably, everyone was.
Yeah. But there were a couple of organizations, Good Samaritan Project now, Thrive Health, and KC Free now, KC Cares. They were kind of on the front line of HIV service delivery, and they helped. It's funny thing. The AIDS service agencies really—I was like the flavor of the month. They were happy to see me because they understood too that the demographics were changing. They needed more love, compassion, support, especially with African Americans, and nobody was stepping up. And so they were happy. Health department was happy that we decided to help. And then the other group was congregations and church folks. They weren't as happy with the decision, and some decided that we couldn't be friends anymore and that we were out there too far and we shouldn't be there. AIDS was a judgment. It's God's judgment, and those people deserve what they got. And
how did you feel about hearing those kinds of comments? How did you process them?
Clergy is a very tight, small, rigid fraternity, mainly, and it's easy to become blackballed and set aside as an albatross or an infidel or whatever, and didn't feel good. And so being rejected by those that you feel that you're most like is, yeah.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it hurt.
Did it intimidate you?
No. I'm not one that gets intimidated very easily, unless it comes from a wife. She can.
I think I'm going to need to hear more about her.
She's a beautiful soul inside and out, and has been a significant part of my life and ministry. And I can't say enough about Brenda.
We will get back to her, but this event, this moment where you took on this one funeral, and that it seems to have been a completely transformative experience for you as a pastor and as a person. Tell me more about that, the transformation.
Well, you know, I've always been a nice guy. And so, and again, this pain and burden, initially my big ministry burden was gangs and kids, you know, troubled youth in Kansas City was in a bad way. And so some of those funerals and some of those ministry times were with people that who had been shot, didn't have a pastor, didn't have a church home. And so that wasn't new. You know, responding to pain wasn't new. This is just a different kind of pain. And the risk associated with HIV were massive, and I'm not sure if I even realized how it would shake out when I finally made the decision. I didn't know the intensity of it.
Can we back up? Because I think that in order to understand the significance of this event, we need to understand it a little bit better in terms of before and after. You grew up in Kansas City. What part of town did you live in as a kid?
64130.
A zip code.
Zip code. One writer tagged it as the murder factory. And the inference was that nothing good comes from 64130. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I came from 64130.
Yeah, it sounds like this was a painful kind of media moment for you, the murder factory reference.
Yeah. It inferred some things. Are there problems in 64130? Yep. Health disparities it's difficult for me to rationalize how the life expectancy for someone in 64109 can be so far different from those that live in 64130 and others that are similar to that. It's race. It's privilege. It's oppression. It's all those things. This is a systemic thing that needs to be changed.
That's now. I'm curious what it was like growing up for you in that zip code.
We didn't know the complete total ramifications, but things were, I think, a lot worse. In retrospect, when we were growing up as teens, 63rd Street was the boundary, and if you passed 63rd Street at night while driving, you could expect to get hassled greatly, or beat, or it was just that kind of a world.
That was the norm.
That was the norm.
When you think back on you're looking back on these memories with adult eyes, do you remember how all of this looked to you with child eyes?
One story that I will relate is busing. And so I remember that I was bused from 39th and College to what was then J.C. Nichols. This is the first attempt at busing. And I think there were one side of our block went to J.C. Nichols. The other side went to another school that I can't recall. And we got there, and I thought it was a welcoming party. We had like four busloads of black kids. I was in the lead bus. I was the first one to get off the bus. I'm like, this is a this is a welcoming party. But what it was the kid took my lunch. He snatched my little ruffled bag out of my hand and then ran up the street with it. I'm like, you know, what's going on here? And by the time I catch up with him, and we had to run to catch up with him, by the time I get there, he's feeding my lunch to a dog. And I'm in fourth grade, and I beat him. Yeah, I hit him. And then the others started fighting, and all of a sudden I'm an instigator of violence. And so this was my entree to
what a first day of school. I mean, when I think about any kid having a first day at a new school.
Yeah. But it did teach me a lot. It was a rude awakening to the fact that there are differences and that people see them. Now you're forced with the idea of, you know, what to do about it. I was able to make friends. I was able to become a leader at the school, safety captain, Rotary Club, all the cool things. But the initial entree was rude and painful.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We will get right back to this portrait session with Reverend Eric Williams. Up next, Eric remembers singing in church as a kid. He also remembers how a desire to work in law enforcement gave way to his ministry. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Reverend Eric Williams, best known here in town for his service to communities that have lost people to HIV and AIDS. We just heard about Eric's upbringing in a zip code once dubbed the Murder Factory. That label left him feeling like his entire community was misunderstood. So now let's hear what that community was instead of what it wasn't. Eric, I am curious, was faith always a part of your life, even at a young age?
There's this notion about church folks, and there's this one song that says, my mama drugged me. And you're supposed to say, she drugged you? Yeah, she drugged me to church, you know. And so there was, and church was it. There were only three stations, you know. You got to do something.
You're talking about the television stations,
right?
Yeah, I remember the three stations.
Yeah,
also.
Yeah. So you got to entertain yourself some way. And so there was Vacation Bible School. There was Sunday night, Sunday morning, Sunday this, Wednesday that, and so. Church and faith was a big part of our growing up. Dad was a deacon. Mom taught Sunday school. There was no question about whether we were going to attend church. It was an automatic.
What was that like for you? Did you like it?
I did. I gravitated toward the music. The music is rich and warm and inspirational and wonderful.
What church did you grow up in? Can you tell me about it?
Sure. It was called the Paradise Baptist Church, still in existence, in the about 58th, 59th, and the Paseo, formerly Martin Luther King Drive.
And then formerly, yeah.
Yeah, that's where we hung out. That's where Brenda and I were married. That's where I accepted the call to ministry. I was a choir director and just loved to sing. We did prison ministry where we'd go prisons across the United States and sing to the inmates and encourage, give them hope. I just love it. Just,
did you have a lot of interaction with the inmates during those experiences?
We were able to have some, enough. You know, because it was pretty scary to hear those doors lock, and you're just there.
You know, I am curious about. You mentioned that your father was a deacon and your mother was a Sunday school teacher. What were they like beyond that, and what did they teach you? It's a big question.
That's a huge question, and Dad, seventh grade education, made certain that we were clothed and fed, worked several different kinds of jobs, cab driver. He worked at Armco Steel. He, for a while, we did trash hauling. You know, that's when they burned the trash, and it was heavy and dirty, and it's not the cool, cute, sanitary trash that we got nowadays. It's very icky, but it really helped to frame a great work ethic in me. Kids teased me a lot. They called us Sanford and Son, and I was the big dummy.
Oh.
But, you know, kids can be cruel, and
yeah.
And you have to learn how to rise above it and be who you are.
Tell me more about how you learned that. I mean, that seemed like a valuable lesson for anyone. What was the – do you remember the process of learning to rise above it?
You do you. You try to maintain success, educational success, athletic success. You know who you are, know where you come from. And you get a good joke in every once in a while on somebody else.
I'm surprised to hear about this from a pastor.
Well, I haven't always been a pastor.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not turning the other cheek.
It is not. It is not. It is not. You have to. Those are learned behaviors. They're not. They can't be forced. You have to submit to that and find ways to do that. I've not always been good at it. Matter of fact, I struggle with it sometimes, even yet today. It's hard to turn that cheek because there's always something waiting for you. And just because you're turning the cheek doesn't mean other people are just going to say, "Oh, he's so nice." You know, they're gonna go for the gusto. So you got to be prepared for that.
What would you say as someone who has taken both approaches in life? You know, what do you see as the value in turning the cheek?
The value is the fact that you can win people.
Lovingly.
Both, yeah, yeah. And in many of the cases in my adulthood, when I've turned the cheek, they didn't hit. They didn't. Sometimes it's an embrace. Sometimes it's a kiss. Sometimes they just walk away and say, "Eh." But occasionally you win people.
What was it that called you to go into the ministry? You originally wanted to go into law enforcement, I understand.
Yeah, there was, you know, and I think a lot of it was, I told you about the boundaries of 63rd Street and the mistreatment from police. I felt that maybe if I could be one of those, that I could help to change from the inside what would happen for especially people of color. I was able to work alongside police in an analyst role.
What does that mean?
Well, it was a research analyst. At the time, the Kansas City Police Department was being attacked by the Justice Administration about hiring practices and promotional practices and the applications and they wanted to make certain that it was fair for people of color. And so I got a good chance to look at the entire department, how they did things, how they operated, and I'm like, yeah, this is a pretty crappy organization and it's not going to change. And I just didn't feel the change coming in the 80s, you know, and it didn't fit me. I had watched all the Mod Squad pictures and all that and wanted to make a difference there, but I just didn't feel that it was good. So I decided to take the other route, which was corrections, and especially with kids. Did a lot of work with the YMCA of Greater Kansas City in juvenile justice-related programming, counseling, case management, working with families, the Job Corps, again, case management, working with families. And that seemed to fit my personality a little bit better.
And then where did the ministry enter into this picture?
Yeah, it was probably all along. In retrospect, it was, I guess, there all the time. But again, you have to submit to it. You have to understand it and agree to it.
So when did that happen? How did that happen?
That happened when I bought a new car. I bought a beautiful new car. It's a Datsun 200SX. And right off the showroom floor, it had this cool blue stripe. I had never bought a new car. It was my first new car. And so I was driving to work to Excelsior Springs, and a car forced me off the road. The car flipped like three times. I ended up, the car's I'm upside down in a ravine without a scratch. The car was about totaled, but I didn't have a scratch. And so I said, yeah, maybe God's trying to tell me something. And so I quickly made a decision after that to go ahead and dedicate and submit and to do this ministry thing.
You know, you said in that interview with StoryCorps that everything good you've been able to accomplish started with a burden. In the context of that particular story, you said that AIDS burdened you. But I'm curious about the greater meaning behind that statement about burdens and transformation, like out of a burden. You've talked about many burdens, though not using those words in the course of this conversation already. The burden of wearing a zip code with a certain reputation on your back, the burden of race and everything that means in terms of divisions within a city and systemic forces that burden some people more than others. Can you talk about how you see those burdens, as the good in those burdens, if that's a fair thing to say, or you know, just how you understand the role of burden in your life?
A lot of people in religion and faith, they refer to, they always ask the question, what is your vision for this, your vision for that? And it almost suggests that you see things that other people don't see. And maybe there's some truth to that. But I call myself sightless in so many ways. And when I react, it's because of the pain and the burden of others.
That's not vision so much as experience.
Yeah, I guess. I for instance, you know, responding to gangs, we pushed ourselves. We're responding to HIV, we created those ministries. Responding to obesity and heart disease and stroke that African Americans are leading the list in. We opened the wellness centers, full service fitness facility that we can offer for the community.
At your church.
At our church. Those are the burdens. And you see those images and it makes you build fitness centers. Who knew Jack LaLanne was right?
When you think about the idea of what it is to be religious, to be spiritual, to be Christian and Baptist specifically, any of those things, that the first thing that comes to people's mind would not be the gym, the exercise facility. Can you talk a little bit about the religious piece of that, creating a space for exercise?
The text that I like to use comes from 3 John, beloved. I wish above all things that you'd prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospers. Sometimes we're so focused on the soul till we forget about life, and we forget about those things that affect life, and not understanding sometimes that if the people at your church are sick, they can't really have the abundant life that we keep preaching about. Or if they pass away with AIDS, that the pews will be empty. You know, if they're hampered by gun violence, you have to justify that in your mind. So, and I'm sure we still have some detractors that say, well, no, you should be an evangelist and you should just stick to the Bible and stick to Sunday school and vacation Bible school and just do that. My burden won't allow me to do that.
One of the burdens that has come up a lot that we haven't discussed in a lot of depth is the burden of gun violence.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, I do.
Again, that's another of my burdens. And
how did you initially come to start feeling the weight of that burden?
So a couple of things. My nephew, my sister adopted him and his brother when they were very, 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 very young. They had a hellish childhood, cigarette burns, you know, addictions, yada, yada, yada. She provided safe space for them to grow and to learn, education, food. She literally saved their lives until one day one of them went to the bus stop at like 39th and Troost, and he was murdered in there. And
how old was he?
Probably 18, 19. Just boom, just right there in a right broad daylight. You know,
I can't imagine the pain of that.
No, that's sheer pain. And then one of the few solved murders, they did apprehend the gentleman. We sat in the courtroom, and my sister, in one of her bravest moments, she, you know, stood in the court. She was allowed to give remarks, and was able to talk to him and tell him that she forgives him. I'm like, no, don't. No, she really did. And just uncommon love. Who forgives the one that kills their son? Oh, maybe God. That's what he did in Jesus. He forgave us, those who killed his son. So that was a real Jesus moment.
We have to take one more break. We will continue our portrait session with Reverend Eric Williams here on Central Standard in just a minute. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking with Reverend Eric Williams about his ministry. It's taken some unlikely turns, including a recent move to open a fitness center for his church community and a project that's been going on for a long time to provide AIDS education in his church. Mind you, this is a Baptist church, and that's the part I want to understand more clearly right now. Reverend Williams, I'm curious, what distinguishes a Baptist church from other kinds of churches? I honestly don't have the sort of background to know that.
Here's the first thing I'll say about that, and it helps you understand why kids hang out in gangs, because the adults do. So if Baptists can't get along with Church of God in Christ, or Pentecostals, or Catholics, or, you know, we're the carrier of gangs, and sometimes we let the gang violence out, and our tongues, and what we say about each other, how we treat each other, how we judge each other. And we're giving all the wrong examples, I think, to kids who are struggling with trying to grow up. what makes Baptists different than others, I think probably our feelings about autonomy, how we are organized, and so that there's no bishop or pope or anyone outside of that particular congregation that mandates or forces a congregation to do anything.
Huh.
Has some good things and some bad things about it. One of the bad things is there's no support from the outside.
For a pastor, for a congregation,
right,
for...
Right. But Baptists, again, gather in what they call conventions. And so there's a National Baptist Convention, there's a Southern Baptist Convention, there's all these different gangs that you can affiliate with.
I am intrigued that you are calling these gangs.
I'll probably get some emails, but it's how we survive. It's how we make things work.
There is a violence you see in it, though.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm really going to get in trouble now. So even stances that we take against homosexuality or abortion or this, that. And so we gather in places that have the same kind of ideas that we have. That's a natural. It's really a natural thing.
Humans do it in a lot of different ways.
It's like, you know, the smokers always go out. It's 3 degrees, but they're standing together. They're together. And it's human nature. And so I'm not suggesting – yes, I am. That there's anything wrong with it, but I think you ought to be able to find grace in the gathering, and come back together to support wonderful things.
I want to get back actually to your AIDS and HIV ministry. What is it like to be a spiritual leader for families and communities dealing with HIV and AIDS from the pulpit of a Baptist church in Kansas City in particular?
Well, and let's go back to the independence of the Baptist church. I don't report to anybody other than my congregation and my God. And so what those would say outside, I've learned that my calling is my calling. I know what I believe, and I believe I know what I'm doing. Now, we try to help other congregations by not changing their theological beliefs about if homosexuality is right or wrong. That's not our avenue. We're not dealing with that. We look at this as a public health crisis, and that all hands need to be on deck. I can't tell another congregation how to support, but I can encourage them to go back to love. Love is the basis for all that God has done throughout eternity.
Tell me more about what it is you do exactly in this particular aspect of your ministry?
Sure. One is just being there to listen and support and to pass along resources. There are resources available in Kansas City. Kansas City is a leader in terms of care and support. But it doesn't help if those who are affected don't know about it. AIDS is completely preventable, but if you get it, it becomes more now of a manageable disease.
If you don't mind, I'd love to hear about some of the people you've met on this path, the stories they've shared that have deepened your own understanding of both the burden that you were feeling when you initially thought about AIDS and thought about the needs out there surrounding AIDS, but also stories that have deepened your own spirituality or touched you in some other way.
Yeah, one quick one. I told you I like to sing. I love to sing. The verdict's still out whether I'm any good at it, but I love to do it. And so I was invited to sing at the National AIDS Conference. I think it was in Denver.
Sounds to me like the verdict is not still out in that case. But go on.
It was a cool thing. It was during one of the big plenaries, and it was a lunch thing, and I was able to sing my song. I was scared to death. Did okay. And then, I think out of the 15,000 folks that were there, my wife and I were probably the only straight couple. And this was early in the thing. And I'm like, okay, why am I here?
Around what year are you talking about?
It has to be early 90s, very early 90s. And why am I here? Why am I here? What am I doing? So, in those conferences, there's always the exhibit hall where they try to sell things, and I'm there, and this flamboyantly gay guy came running up with his arms open, and I kind of cringed, and he stepped back and he looked at me like, "You're not that cute." And I said, okay. He said, I just came to tell you that when you were singing, I've never felt anything like this. I felt like God was in the room and that he loved me. And I said, aha, that's why I'm here. Because there are people who don't think God loves them, or that people love them, or that the church doesn't love them, and maybe this is part of my job.
And I imagine you had to confront that cringe.
I continually confront the cringe. I don't understand all of this. I don't understand it. But some things, I guess, are not mine to understand. It's just a fact of treating people the way that I want to be treated, with dignity and honor, kindness.
What have you learned about Kansas City and Kansas City's communities through this ministry?
I think I started telling you about being the flavor of the month for providers. They loved us. I told you about pastors and congregations kind of hating us, but I didn't tell you about gay men. They were initially they took a lot of their anger out on me as the representative from church. And the question is like, okay, why are you here now? And my brother's died, and why are you here now? My lover died. Why? You're the judge. You're the carrier of all this icky stuff. And so
your presence had sort of, they saw a hostility in your presence.
Well, they saw traditional church values. I don't wear a collar or anything. I don't walk around with the robe on. I do have a cross, but I don't push it. But it's kind of cool never having to say anything about Jesus, but people understanding that that's who you're representing. I don't have to wear the T-shirt. Sometimes that's really, really, really cool. But initially with the gay community, I was the evil one. And so we had to prove that we were there for the long haul. We had to prove that we were there for the right reasons. We had to prove that what we were carrying was love. I'm proud to be embraced by the gay, white, and black communities. I'm proud of that. I remember there was one meeting I was in, and he's he pointed his finger, "You're too straight." And I'm like, "Okay, you're too gay." And it was the friction that occurred. And after we both said what we said, I think we both realized how stupid we sounded. And we became really good friends. He almost got fired for talking to the preacher like that. But it really turned out well. But it doesn't happen until you get in the same room. It just doesn't.
You know, we started this conversation by talking about the fact that AIDS burdened you and the mental and spiritual burden you felt that moved you to action. What burdens you today?
Yeah, so this violence thing, there was a young lady who I guess learned of us because of the fitness center. So she came to start working out, and then she met a bunch of folks, and then she joined our church. Yeah, in the process of time, she met the wrong guy, fell in love with the wrong guy. He wasn't a member of our church. Late one night, she and her two boys, one a 9-year older and one who was a toddler, they were over at her mom's house. The boyfriend comes and kicks in the door and kills the grandmother, kills my member, starts chasing the kids. The kids are trying to escape. One 9-year-old plucks his toddler out of the arms of his dying grandmother. Goes to one door, can't get out. Goes to another door, can't get out. Finally gets out through a window and saves his brother's life. The shooter finally committed suicide. He was about to be apprehended. But my concern is what happens to the 9-year-old or what happens to the toddler? And how do you unsee some of the things that you see? I get frustrated. For instance, Blue Springs, a kid dies late at night in an accident, car accident. The next morning at the school, there's counselors and they're helping kids through the experience, through the trauma of it. It doesn't seem to happen in Midtown. And we just kind of pat the kids and say, "Go on back to school. It's going to be all right." Trauma doesn't
trauma isn't just all right.
No, you can't unsee that. You don't get over that without help. You don't. And so, this new burden, I need to be able to provide kids with the counseling services that they need, the case management as they deal with trauma. We're building a sound studio at our church, sound, video, STEM programming, so that the kids can have safe spaces to hang out after school, Saturdays, evenings. I wish I had a nickel for every black boy who has a rap song or beat, as they call it. I'd be a rich guy. So why not channel some of that? Why not use rap in performance to teach English? Why not teach them backroom stuff? Why not teach them how to interview? How come we can't do podcasts with rich content so that their friends can hear them and they get kudos and they get warm fuzzies and they preach without preaching and they influence their peers and in a spirit of activism and change and information and behavior change, make them the stars and let them shine and give them hope.
Reverend Eric Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you, Miss Gina.
Eric Williams is the pastor of Calvary Temple Baptist at 30th and Holmes. This has been a portrait session. Pretty soon you'll be able to see pictures of Eric along with his story at kcur.org. This time tomorrow, KCUR will be carrying coverage of the impeachment debate. Team Central Standard will be hard at work behind the scenes, and then we'll be back on Thursday with a look back not just at the year, but the decade. What were the memorable moments for Kansas City? Start talking about it on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and you can join the conversation on the air this Thursday. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.